The One Way Trail by Max Brand. The shifter picked up a chair from the circle around the stove, and drawing it back a little so that no one could easily pass between him and the wall, he sat down to think. With the shifter, thinking was a process quite unusual. He ordinarily acted first and did his thinking afterward. Thinking was so strenuous a task that he needed utter repose of body while his mind struggled. Not that the shifter was stupid, far from it, but he was only 22 years old, and though he had crammed enough action into that narrow span of life to furnish sufficient excitement to a dozen able-bodied men, he had never encountered a problem which could not be solved by the adroit use of his 185 pounds of mule-hard muscle. Or, if muscle alone could not gain the desired end, he possessed gun sense. But today it was different. He'd returned to his hometown of Logan after 4 years, expecting smiles and open arms as a hero. Over the 4 years, he had not forgotten a single face or voice, but the applause greeting him came so muted as to be non-existent. Old Curry, the town loafer, greeted him, to be sure, with a broad grin and a request for a five spot, but that was about the only smile he encountered. A few minutes later, the sheriff came up to him, Sheriff Joe Brown, who taught him to ride in his childhood.
Now look here, kid. Maybe you come in all ready to light up and celebrate, but my job around these parts is to keep things quiet. You lay to that, and if there's any uncommon trouble starts, I ain't gonna ask questions. I'll just start for you, Shifter, and start pronto.
With that, he turned on his heel and strode off down the veranda. It was this that made the shifter enter the hotel to find a chair and some quiet so he could think. They were all against him, that was plain, and gradually he came to see why. They were afraid of him. Afraid of the shifter. He was like a stranger. Back when they knew him as Harry French, before he went away, he'd been as popular as any youth in the town. Now they seemed to think he had changed his identity when he got the nickname. They avoided his eyes. They didn't enter into conversation with him. And when he entered a group, the group dissolved and reassembled in another place. He would not have been so surprised anywhere else, but here they ought to know him. They ought to understand that all the stories floating through the mountains about him were not entirely true. He was a gunfighter only on occasion, by necessity, not by choice. Could not his people see that at a glance? His thoughts flickered to the mining town of Ferris, where Harry French took the optimism and the fine good humor of an 18-year-old youth. There, on a pay night in the saloon, he got involved without fault of his own in a sudden hurly-burly of fighting men. Somebody chipped his ear with a bullet, and he strove to get out of the sphere of danger. The moment Harry felt the sting of the wound, he lost all desire to escape. He turned back and rushed that crowd, weaving from side to side, smashing out with either hand, bowling over stalwart miners at every punch, until at length a panic took the crowd. They bolted for the door. The town bully remained, drawing his gun. Harry avoided the bullet with a side leap and downed his man with a heavy slug in the thigh. His footwork earned him the sobriquet of the Shifter. It was an instinct that made him do it. Ever after, when he entered a fight and rushed his man, he came swerving and dodging like a football player slicing through tacklers. The Shifter never picked trouble, never forced combat. Trouble hunted him down. Now folks looked upon him, even these men of his hometown, as little better than a legal murderer who picked fights to destroy his foes. He raised his head to discover that every eye rested upon him, and instantly every glance turned in another direction. They did not want to be found staring, for a gunfighter would pick a fight at the very slightest provocation. In fact, every one of those men, hardy fellows though they were, was sweating with anxiety as long as he sat in their midst. What fools! Could they not see that his one consuming desire was to be friendly? Tears of vexation and self-pity rose to the eyes of the shifter. His scowl grew blacker as he studied the floor, looking down to hide that suspicious moisture. The shifter looked up to find a tall, raw-boned man staring at him with a face deathly pale. He wore a look of desperation about his face. The lips of the tall man worked a moment before sound came.
You got my chair, French!
Sudden understanding came to the shifter. Here was Long Tom Cassidy, whom the shifter knew like a brother before. Now Long Tom stood ready to battle. If an ordinary fella had taken the chair, Tom would never have dreamed of raising an objection. After all, he held no power or right to reserve his seat when he left the room. It just happened that on this occasion, when he returned, he found every chair taken, and in his own recently abandoned place sat a killer of men. He felt he would be shamed. Sooner than be shamed, Long Tom Cassidy was ready to die. It came home to the shifter of a sudden, and it made him sick at heart. What could he do? He would rather drive a bullet into his own flesh than shoot down Cassidy. But could he meekly rise from his rightful place and surrender it to another? Perhaps Cassidy built up a reputation for skill with weapons in the past 4 years. Perhaps he might be capable of putting up a desperate battle, and the others would think that fear motivated the shifter to make him move. The shifter didn't want to fight. His heart ached to go up and greet Tom with a hearty handshake, but he couldn't. The others in the room gradually began to shift their chairs out of the line of possible fire. Their sympathies plainly lay with Tom. The shifter looked them over with the sad eye of despair and found not a single kindly response to his glance.
You heard me talk!
Tom, don't be a fool. You ain't got this chair mortgaged, I guess.
Look here, just save your words for them that'll stand them. I ain't your dog to be booted out of a chair and then jawed because I want it back.
A spark of rage fanned in the shifter, a familiar red blur that preceded all his battles. But he controlled himself, leaning back in the chair and running the tip of his tongue over his white lips.
Cassidy, you're hunting trouble. Cut it out. I'm not going to fight about a chair, even if you want to.
Then get out of it!
The shifter stared at the big man for a moment in silence, thinking harder than he had ever thought before. He decided to surrender. It was hard to do. It would bring doubt and some suspicion of cowardice upon him. But at least it would prove to the people of his own hometown that he didn't wish to force trouble on peaceful men. He leaned to rise. What happened then was simply misapprehension and bad luck, though unquestionably the first movement of a man leaning to rise from a chair and the first movement of a man leaning to get at his gun are the same. At any rate, Tom Cassidy, on edge with excitement, interpreted the movement in the second way and grabbed for his own gun. That gesture the shifter noted from the corner of his eye and saw that he would be forced to fight or die. The shifter dove and landed with his gun in his hand. Long Tom whirled to fire again, giving the shifter no choice. Cassidy gripped violently with both hands at his left thigh as he fell to the floor. A quick examination of Cassidy's wound showed the bullet passed through the flesh only, leaving bone and sinew untouched. He was carried from the room just as the sheriff entered. A gun in either hand, Sheriff Brown went straight for the shifter. As for the shifter, he remained standing idly against the wall with the revolver hanging loosely from his fingertips.
Put up your hands, shifter. Stick them up.
Only the muzzle of the shifter's gun twitched in return.
I'll put them up when I get good and ready. You, Brown, keep on the far side of the stove. Understand?
I'll make this the last fighting you do, bucko.
Sheriff Brown remained on the far side of the stove.
I used to think you were a man, Brown, but I see you ain't. They don't raise him that way around Logan. I come back here ready to act peaceable as a pet dog. First thing I know, an idiot starts a fight about a chair. I leave it to the gent standing around here. Did I pick that fight? What? Do you mean to say I started it? Wasn't I getting up out of the chair just the way he ordered me to do? Wasn't I taking water from him when the hound drew on me and I had to jump to save my neck?
Not a word. The shifter knew he was beaten. He looked back at Joe Brown.
Well, Sheriff, I see I get no backing. These blockheads can't see straight. They do, they can't remember what they see. Point now is, what do you mean to do?
The sheriff ran his eyes around the circle and wondered. It might be that his reputation as a man-taker would be in this affair. But if the fight started, he himself would be the first target for that tall, gray-faced youth. It was a convincing thought.
I tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna run you out of this town, Shifter, and I'm gonna make it hot for you if you ever try to come back. If I had a shade more against you, I'd lock you up now. But I figured Long Tom Cassidy made a fool play. Anyway, Shifter, out you go and on the run, too.
The sheriff saw an unmistakable air of relief on every face.
I'll walk, Brown. I was never built for running.
The Shifter deliberately shoved his revolver back into the holster, tilted his sombrero to a more rakish angle, settled his bandana into a more flowing knot, and slowly sauntered across the floor with his pale blue eyes wandering from side to side, daring them all, or anyone, to make the first move to detain him or to hurry him. He reached the door, and with his back turned squarely toward the mall, he opened it and stepped out into the staggering gale. The Shifter was through. His own people had denied him. They had refused to give him a chance or a hearing. They had set themselves shoulder to shoulder against him. And if he hadn't been hurt to the very heart, he could have laughed at their folly. Inside a quarter of a mile, Glorious, the Shifter's ordinary brute of a roan horse, settled down to a long, easy canter, defying the force of the wind and even pricking his ears into it. In fact, Glorious was never so happy as when he was underway on a long journey and a hard one. He drew the big horse down to a steady jog in anticipation of the long and hard trail that lay before them, for the Shifter intended to take the seldom-used one-way trail across the Kendall Mountains to Varden City. There were other trails across the mountains. Still, the one-way trail ran the shortest. Rushing down from the loftier peaks of the Varden Mountains in the north, the Kendall River cut a narrow trench through the mountains of the same name, a gorge with sides nearly as sheer as the walls of a room. Along one side of the gorge slithered a difficult trail. In half a dozen places one could pass, but mile after mile it stretched as a narrow little ledge where a man on foot faced danger and where a man on a horse continually risked his own neck and the life of his mount. In recognition of this fact, an unwritten law held that the trail should be used only by travelers from the south to the north to avoid any more head-on meetings that in the early days caused more than one tragedy. As the Shifter approached the trail, he considered his future. His plan for life hereafter was to be free from violence. He would move into a section of the mountains where he was unknown. There he would settle down, carve for himself the repute of honest, patient, and law-abiding citizen. This idea was strong in his mind as Glorious jogged up the last grade, turned about the shoulder of a mountain, and came suddenly upon the gorge of the Kendall River and the beginning of the one-way trail. It was unlike any other gorge he'd ever seen. Though he remembered it well enough from other days, it came upon him now like something seen for the first time. Other things had changed greatly in 4 years, but the one-way trail along the valley of the Kendall seemed more terrible than ever. The walls went up on either hand to the very summits of the range, 1,000 feet from river to sky, as though the chain of the mountains had been stretched from each side until they snapped asunder along a smooth line of cleavage. He looked down. The Kendall flowed through shadows, save where a shaft of sunlight was here and there reflected from the polished face of a cliff and brightened the water. In those places, he could make out the foam-white surface of that troubled water. The trail was almost indistinguishable as it wound here and there, climbing with well-nigh imperceptible footings from one jutting crag to another. Sometimes it was merely a distant scratch along the blank walls of stone. The big horse leaned far forward into the heart of the wind before he could take the first step, and then they stepped out onto the trail, with Glorious pressing close to the wall, fearful of the dizzy fall on his right. In half a mile, he had lost his first terror and was giving himself to his work with consummate skill. Glorious literally smelled his way to safety around every corner and then took the turn with his head lowered and his long, snaky neck stretched out. He made such a ridiculous appearance in the midst of this maneuver that Harry French couldn't help himself. Glorious merely trudged on, regardless of the mockery. Within 10 minutes, Glorious developed a perfect technique, the chief point being that at all times he kept his long body pressed closely to the wall, even when the trail was comfortably broad. Once his mount had gained this surety of going, the shifter forgot to a great extent the dangers of the way. He almost lost himself in his thoughts. They ran almost entirely to the new life that would begin at the end of this trail. It was a melancholy series of reflections. He felt that his past life was behind him, that 22 years had been wasted. When a boy reaches that age, he feels that a very great deal indeed has been passed. So the shifter considered the future with a gloomy sobriety of mind. Out of his past, every remembered face became a dead thing. Every remembered voice, a ghost. The shifter was brought out of these dreary reflections, these grave plans for the future, by a sharp prick of reality. Glorious stopped. The shifter looked up and found facing him a youthful rider on a big brown horse. The trail was not 3 feet wide. Even two men in passing would have leaned in against the wall, so dizzying was that fall. It was impossible for even the most adroit and cat-footed Mustang to turn in this space. For horses as large as Glorious and the Brown, it was absurd to attempt such a maneuver. Neither could they back the horses to a possible turning place, for behind each was the bend which had just been rounded. If the horses could barely make way around those turns going ahead, it would be a certain fall to force the animals against instinct to back up around. Besides, it might be a mile in either direction to an advantageous spot. The shifter adjusted himself in the saddle so that that cunning right hand of his would be perilously near the holster, ready for use, while he studied the stranger. The man was apparently between 25 and 30, perhaps even more. He was well-built, rather stocky and broad-shouldered compared to the athletic ranginess of the shifter, but brown with outdoor life and sufficiently deep of chest to promise unusual power in a hand-to-hand effort. The head, however, was not so formidable as the body. It was distinctly small, and the face was small likewise, with handsome features extremely regular in cut and oddly contrasted with the aquiline cast of the shifter. The eyes, too, were set closely together, and in their restless quality, they suggested an unhealthy cunning. Yet whatever the physical possibilities of the stranger, never had the shifter seen a man so obviously in the grip of the frozen hand of terror. He sat in his saddle with mouth agape, staring, his face bloodless. When he attempted to speak, Harry French couldn't make out a sound. This plainly declared to the shifter that he was the master of the situation. This trembler would make no stern opposition to his will and his ways. But also, it was a thing so disgusting to watch that the shifter blinked and looked away.
Well, what do you make out of this business? What do we do?
What do I make out of it? What I want to know is what you mean by riding up this trail in the face of a wind like this. Are you crazy?
You told yourself you'd try to find a peaceful way now. So try to find it. Seems to me that I'm the one that has the right to ask questions. This here's a one-way trail, I guess. I'm riding it the right way and you're riding it the wrong way. Got anything to say to that?
Plenty to say. I'm in a hurry. I gotta get to the end of the gorge. That's why I'm riding this way.
Same with me. I'm riding this trail because I'm in a hurry.
In a hurry? In a hurry? So you buck into a wind like this? Why, it was all me and my hoss could do to keep the trail with the wind behind us. In a hurry.
He regarded the shifter with a fierce contempt. In his entire life, the shifter had never met with a man who so keenly aroused his hatred.
Look here, there's one thing plain. These two horses can't get by each other. I'm not saying who's to blame for it, but I'll give you a fair break. One horse has to die and drop down into the Candle River. No other way out.
The other horse goes on through, and the gent that loses his has to finish his trip on foot. We'll throw a coin, partner, to see who loses and who keeps his horse.
So saying, he drew forth a broad half-dollar piece and juggled it in his hand. But his heart was by no means as light as his manner. There was not a sinew in the big, ugly, powerful body of Glorious that the shifter did not love. Only there was nothing else to be done.
Throw a coin to see which horse dies? Say, friend, do you think I'd risk a horse like the general here against a skinny old ramshackle like your own?
You've said a tolerable pile, and you've said a pile too much. You got talking to do, try out your tongue on something beside my horse.
In a way, I'm in the wrong, and I brought this mess about. Well, I'll pay you the price of your horse. I'll pay you a good price, too.
Do you think a horse means just so much money to me? Why, stranger, a horse is a life, just the way you and me are lives. You can't buy a horse. You may pay somebody a price, but you ain't paying a price to the horse. Pile of gents sit the saddles on horses that they don't own a hair of because they ain't never taught the horse to love them.
Bah! You talk plumb ridiculous. This is my horse. Got my brand on him, bought with my money. He's just horse flesh to be used like soap or oil or coal.
All right. Maybe that's all he is to you. I'm sorry.
For what?
For the horse.
What do you mean?
The shifter suddenly swung forward in his saddle, clinging with trembling knees to the sides of Glorious, and his face was gray and drawn. Save for his eyes, he seemed to be in a panic, but the eyes bore an ample assurance that he was in a red fury. The stranger shrank, and his own eyes grew dim and wide.
Now talk business. Shall I throw the coin?
All right. If it's gotta be that way. But let me get close enough to see the coin fall.
So saying, he urged his mount a few steps nearer until the head of the brown was bobbed near that of Glorious, and on the inside. What was about to come, the shifter had no means of guessing, save that as he took the half dollar on top of his thumb, preparatory to snapping it into the air, he saw that the hand of the stranger on the bridle rein was trembling and gripped hard. He snapped the coin high, raised his head to watch its twinkling rise, and just when it hovered brightly at the height, it happened.
Yeah!
The brown horse drove at him. He was perfectly helpless. With head thrown up, urged on by the driving of the spurs in his tender flanks, the brown came in with maddened eyes, driving between Glorious and the cliff.
Yeah! Yeah! Get on, General! Yeah!
There was no time to whip out a gun and shoot, no time to fling himself from the saddle, no time to even throw his weight toward the cliff to steady Glorious, for the rush of the brown forced the roan straight up and back, rearing and toppling on his hind legs. The shifter looked down. Far below him, with nothing between, rushed the Kendall. The upward and backward lurch of the roan was driving him swiftly to the toppling point. Already he was clinging fiercely with his knees to keep from pitching headlong out of the saddle. He saw to the side and before him the convulsed face of the stranger as he pressed the brown in and with his quirt showered stinging blows over the head of the roan. Glorious, with a squeal of rage and fear and pain, rocked and balanced erect as a bear on his hind legs. The one great forehoof went up, flashed down, again and again and again. He was fighting as wild stallions fight, not submitting tamely to destruction. To escape that crushing, slashing shower of blows, the brown horse in turn reared. The shifter at the same instant flattened himself along the neck of Glorious. He gave his weight to the rush as the roan drove forward on all four legs and now charged like a fighting dog at the throat of the brown. Higher the brown reared to strike with battering forehoofs, even as Glorious had done, but Glorious drove in like a savage terrier, and now the weight of his shoulder ground in between the brown and the cliff. The brown reeled back. The shifter, realizing that their roles had been changed, struggled furiously at the reins to draw Glorious back, but it was like tugging at a stone wall. Higher went the brown, staggered, and pitched sideways into the abyss. Then he swayed far out in the saddle, reached with both hands, and with the right he caught the falling man by the shoulder. The whole length of that arm whipped through his grip. The sleeve tore away like a cobweb under the terrific force of his hand. But the strain checked. As his right hand caught a firm hold on the wrist, the shifter flashed his left across and secured a hold lower down. The shifter found himself suspended for the second time over the gulf of the canyon. Never had he passed through such a moment. The opening of his hand would save himself and send another human being to death. Then, Glorious, struggling hard, caught his balance again and swayed toward the face of the cliff. In a moment, the crisis was over, and the stranger lay senseless on the floor of the trail beside the roan. The shifter himself was trembling like an invalid newly risen from bed when he climbed slowly out of the saddle and kneeled above the rescued stranger. One pressure of his hand assured him that the fellow lived, though the heart beat faintly and the lungs merely stirred. The shifter rose, climbed into the saddle again, and pressed slowly on down the trail. He couldn't force himself to stay until the stranger returned to his senses. He could not stay to hear thanks from the lips of this detestable coward. It took more than 2 hours to do the remaining 6 miles of the trail, with all of its ins and outs, and ups and downs, and hardly a place where he could do better than walk. The shifter rode into the muddy streets of Varden City. He secured a room at the hotel without difficulty, and went up to it at once to lie down to rest. He needed to think, for oddly enough, his first step into a life of kindliness had almost brought him to his death. He lay on the bed with eyes closed, and through his mind passed the picture of what the other Harry French would be doing at this moment. The other Harry French who existed that very morning. He would be down in the lobby of that old building, holding the center of the stage with his stories, with his laughter, with his mockeries. He would be beating down the glances of quieter men with his own defiant and bold eyes. After all, was it not better to live like that, to be feared and respected and followed and admired even by those who dared not imitate him? Was it not better than to lie here in the darkness, brooding over what the future might hold for him? He rose to answer the door and swung it wide. There in the hallway stood a middle-aged man in an immensely wide-brimmed sombrero, and behind him, solidly packed, were half a dozen more. Every eye focused on the face of the shifter with an intensity with which he was bitterly familiar. The leader planted his riding boot inside the door so that it could not be closed. His right hand rested prominently on the butt of his revolver.
You're Harry French.
Who are you to ask?
I got a right to ask questions, son. I'm the sheriff, John Clark.
The thoughts of the shifter danced away into the obscurity of strange reflections. Since his resolution to lead a peaceable life, he had been forced into a brawl by a man he tried to avoid, had been driven from his own hometown, had been nearly murdered on a mountain trail, and now a sheriff with a formidable posse was invading his hotel room to ask him questions. Sheriff Clark, who of course could not follow the trend of these thoughts, was astonished at his laughter. Then the shifter drew back politely.
Come in, gents. Make yourselves to home. Sorry I ain't got anything to offer you to drink, but I ain't a drinking man and I hate moonshine anyways.
Gunfighters and card sharps mostly do.
The sheriff kicked the door still wider and strode into the room with his men back behind him. As for the shifter, he saw that a side leap would take him to his gun and belt where they lay on the bed. And then it would be a comparatively simple matter, for him, to jump through the window, onto the roof of the shed beneath, then so down to the ground, and only a few steps from the horses. From the entrance speech of the sheriff, he gathered that the visit forebode him no good. Or were they simply about to invite him to leave the town and ride on? The sheriff walked slowly around the room. He reached the gun belt and picked it up.
I'll keep this a while.
He began to pull the weapon, but the toe of the shifter's boot connected with the sheriff's wrist. The gun spun into the air and fell into the agile hand of the shifter. He stood with his back to the wall, with a semicircle of armed men before him, every man ready to shoot. Again, the shifter could have laughed if it had not been for the fierce and rebellious pain in his heart. For the second time on the first day of his good resolutions, he found the protectors of social quiet arrayed en masse against him with their guns in their hands. The sheriff nursed his injured wrist with his other hand, but he showed no fear.
Watch that window, Bud and Joe. It opens out over the roof of the shed. Lock the door, Charlie, and just light that lamp, will you, Pete? We need more light than we get out of the hall. There's plenty of time to get his gun.
Sure. Sheriff can have my gun any time for the asking, but not for the taking.
Why, you fool.
The flame welled up in the chimney of the lamp as Pete lighted it.
Do you know you've resisted arrest?
You lie.
Nobody's told me I'm under arrest. You started to grab my gun and I kicked it out of your hand. I'd do it again.
All right, Shifter. I'll tell you now that you're under arrest.
That's easy to say. But what's the charge? You can't railroad me, partner.
The charge is murder on the one-way trail. Yes, murder of my son, Jack Clark.
The pale blue eyes of the Shifter narrowed as he stared at the sheriff. But there was no similarity between that brown, hard-featured countenance and the face of the man he saved from falling into the chasm of the Kendall River.
Murder? Murder of a gent on a brown horse? Big-shouldered fellow with a sort of a smallish head and a foolish face?
You hear him, boys? He's identified Jack. I've found him cold-blooded and steady as iron before, but never as bad as this.
He's not dead. He's out on the one-way trail.
The sheriff shook his head.
You saved that talk for the judge. Meantime, will you give up your gun, Peaceable?
Partner, I never play a game that's sure to be a loser. Here it is.
He handed over the weapon.
Hold out your hands. What you say, be remembered for the jury and the judge. But if you want to talk, go ahead. We'll all listen, and we'll all remember.
Do you think that I'd have let you get me so dead easy if I was afraid my yarn wouldn't hold? I'll tell you the straight of it.
As the Shifter reached the part of the tale describing the horse flailing into the abyss, the sheriff winced.
But I grabbed your man as he was falling, and I pulled him back onto the trail. He fainted plumb away from the scare. I made out that his heart was still beating, and then I rode on down the trail. And that, gents, is the straight of the story. I swear it. Either he's in Logan by this time, or else he's still on that trail.
There was something so convincing about the manner in which the story was told, incredible though some of the mentioned incidents were, that the men of the posse looked from one to the other after the fashion of men whose conviction has been shaken and who are willing to hear more reason. But the sheriff, though his eye had brightened, shook his head.
We'll give it a chance, son. We'll send a man to ride the trail and we'll wire down to Logan to see if Jack has come in yet. But the fact is that Jack has had plenty of time to have got to Logan long before this. Soon as I had word that that fool boy had took the one-way trail in the wrong direction, I wired on ahead to Logan and asked if anybody had entered the trail from that end. I got word back right off that you were just starting up that way. Well, Shifter, next we heard was that Jack's brown hoss had come rolling and tumbling down the Kendall, all smashed to pieces. But no Jack had come through. Then we see you, big as life, riding out of the one-way trail. And you didn't have no story to tell till just now. Why didn't you talk out as soon as you come in? Wasn't it worth talking about?
Go ride the trail. You'll find him. You can leave me in the lockup till he's located. I guess that's square all around.
The Shifter found himself locked up in the large home of the Clarks that also served as the town jail. The stout cellar wall offered a greater security than any other building in the town and saved the village the expense of a public structure. To the sheriff himself, it was a double advantage, for on the one hand, he received a generous fee for lodging the guests of the county, and on the other, the fact that he owned the jail was a sort of automatic assurance he would get reelected to the office of sheriff so long as he cared for the position. A fencing of steel bars had been constructed like a great netting throughout the cellar and was divided and subdivided into a dozen cells, though more than half of that number had never been occupied at one time. At the present moment, there was not a single tenant on any of the little cots. The Shifter was assigned to the central cell, which had the advantage of offering him no concealment from spying eyes.
There ain't any town of our size in the mountains that can show a better jail or a safer jail.
The sheriff smiled with becoming modesty as he unlocked the door and ushered the Shifter into his place of confinement. One of the men of the town came back to the Shifter when the party was about to leave, and leaning against the bars, he nodded wisely to the prisoner, from whose hands the manacles had, of course, been removed.
We know you, French. We remember you from the days before you got to be known as the Shifter. Maybe you've turned out bad, as bad as we've heard, and maybe you ain't so bad after all. But you can lay to it that you'll get a square deal in Varden City. Here's wishing you luck.
The Shifter shook hands heartily through the bars.
I'll tell you what. Varden City ain't through with me. I'm about to settle down, partner.
and I've made up my mind that I'll settle down right here. If you folks don't like me to start with, I'll make you like me before I'm through.
The other grinned.
Don't let the sheriff get you worried so you try to bust out. He's just natural gloomy, you see?
The good-natured fella left the shifter to his thoughts and retired to retreat with the rest of the party. Alone with the cellar dimly illuminated by the light from a single lantern which swung from a rafter in a corner, the shifter immediately set about examining his surroundings. He had entered the jail in perfect confidence, but when he heard the steel-barred door slam behind him and heard the heavy lock click, his heart had leaped into his throat, as it does when one jumps into cold water. He was trapped, and no matter how harmless his actions had been, the fact that he was helpless was in itself alarming. The size of the lock on the door made him yearn for a key to open it, in spite of his good intentions to let the law take its own course in its own way. Sitting with his head in his hands, for he didn't know how long, he was suddenly startled by the feeling that someone was nearby, watching. Huh? He looked up and found the sheriff, grim and hateful, standing at the bars. He had stolen into the cellar, his footfalls covered by the noise of the storm still drumming outside the house. The shifter, cold with dread, straightened slowly to his feet.
Well?
We've wired to Logan again. Jack ain't there.
He's on the trail, then.
We rode the trail. We've had him ride all the way up from Logan. Jack ain't on the trail.
Then where is he?
Down in the Kendall River, where you throwed him when you killed him.
Sheriff, that's not how
I see you swing for it. You sent him to his death. You sent me to mine. And I'll see that you go down with us. Sleep on that.
His stride may have been long and slow, but his shoulders sagged, as though all in a moment an irresistible load of years had been poured upon him. Between every squeak of the stairs, the sheriff's mind rushed through years of life, years of planning and of hope blasted this night by the shifter. He built his own future on the future of his son, and his son gone, his own hopes of success withered at the root. Not that the heart of the grim man was tender for his offspring. He knew the boy for what he was, a coward, a knave by instinct, and something of a fool. But nevertheless, he had planned to wrest success and wealth from the world through the use of this wretched tool. And he had been on the verge of victory when the tool was torn from his hands. That was why his eyes were fiery when he leaned in at the bars of the shifter's cell. It was an unsavory story, that tale of his life's plans. 10 years before, rich William Chalmers died, leaving his daughter and sole heir in the keeping of John Clark as guardian. The fortune that went with her had been tied up in bonds, all but a small sum for her living expenses, and the very interest upon them could not be touched until Allison Chalmers reached her 18th birthday. The sheriff took custody of his best friend's child with the best of intentions and in all good faith. The gradual wreckage of one business scheme after another did not alter him. Another man would have seen a chance of escape in the future which the girl held as her own, but the sheriff was not of that kind of stuff. True, he conceived the idea of marrying Allison to his son, but he conceived it without malice aforethought. It is true, too, that even as he planned the thing, he knew his son was unworthy of the girl. But in Allison, he also saw the salvation of Jack Clark. Although at times he might shrewdly have guessed that his son was a coward and a knave, as a rule, he closed his eyes to the truth and strove to make himself think that Jack only needed the passage of time to make him into a real man. He could not be wrong. The boy's mother had been a gentle wife whom the sheriff still loved and looked back on with a deep devotion. The sheriff had never been accused of cowardice or of the instincts of a bully. More than once, the very flesh of John Clark crawled when he heard or saw evidence of the mean spirit of his boy. But always he shook his head and returned to reasoning and self-delusion to cover up the fact. It was sad, and it was shameful. But after all, it was natural. He could not despise his own son. Jack must be a good man, in the making. The sheriff would do what he could. When he was done, he depended upon the girl to come to his aid and finish the job. There was one great, almost insuperable obstacle. Allison hated Jack. More than once, this fact made the sheriff draw back from his plans and shake his head. He wanted the girl to be happy. He wanted to secure her future just as much as her own father could have wished it. But what he could not eventually see was that happiness could never be based upon bedrock if she were to be married to his son. Middle-aged people have a strong predisposition toward believing that the ideas of the young are changeable. Time will tell the tale is too often their creed. And that was the sheriff's creed. Time would change Jack, and time would also change the girl. He himself would oversee the marriage and make sure that Jack treated Allison well. Under his oversight, he did not see how matters could go wrong. He forgot his own youth. He forgot a young man's opinion of marriage. Love was something which he left out of his estimate in the full assurance that habit could take its place. The bitter truth is that men who have loved their wives are too apt to think that a man must love a good woman and that a woman can grow accustomed to any man. Struggling with all of this, he struggled too with whether or not it was right to hold Allison back from communion with other boys and girls of her age. On this subject, he debated with himself long and earnestly. His conclusion was wrong, but it was a conclusion honestly reached and honestly maintained. Many a time he said to himself it was fitting that Allison have the right to her own society among the young people of Varden City, and he knew that she would quickly become popular among them. But he knew also that, pretty as she was, she would be very apt to be impressed with one of the youngsters of the town, and this must not be. No doubt it was folly. But the sheriff was honest in his conclusions. The result was that he kept her at home, saddling her with household duties above her years. He knew it was painful to her, but he promised himself that in the future she would be amply rewarded for the pain which she now underwent. After the marriage, if he needed an excuse to seclude her, he found it readily.
She's not very well. You see how pale she is.
All the time he knew that the pallor, the silence, the downward cast eyes were the result of his own regime which he imposed upon her. The full realization of this struck him when he stepped from the parlor to the hallway. There stood Allison carrying a lamp in one hand and a tray of food in the other for the prisoner. He had not heard her coming. It was characteristic of her, this softness of foot. She stole through the house like a phantom, never lifting her eyes even when she was spoken to, even when she answered. Bitterly, the sheriff realized that this was his work. He saw her now for the first time as he stared at her in the dim hallway. How pretty indeed. Here stood a woman who would make some man happy. Possibilities of warmth of soul and of manner were in her. Almost against his will, he had checked and changed those impulses. He should have given her freely to the companionship of those her own age. He had not done so, and for that reason he felt that he had done a hard and cursed thing. Well, now had come the time when he would make amends, most generous amends. He loved the girl. How astonished she would be now when he began to draw upon that store of affection and pour it forth upon her. Curiously, sadly, he gazed upon her. She was like a new creature considered in this different perspective. Yet he was bothered by those downward eyes. She did not lift them when she saw him, but came to a patient halt in enduring silence. Sight of that pale face with the purple-shadowed eyes fell like a whip on the soul of the sheriff. It was his work, and how completely it was his work, only he could tell. But he would make amends now that Jack was dead and his hopes undone. He would make amends in some way. With that good thought, a chain burst somewhere in his heart. Tears rushed to his dry eyes, tears which the loss of Jack had not brought.
Allie, dear,
Her eyes rose. She cast on him a glance of utter astonishment, utter fear, and shrank a little to one side, as though to give him more room for passing her. She was used to curt commands, and this caress in his voice startled her. The sheriff turned and stumbled blindly down the passage. He heard the cellar door close behind her as she reached the stairs. He reached his private office and lighted a match as he entered, fumbling for the lamp. As he replaced the chimney, his left hand froze around the glass, for he was acutely conscious of another presence in the room. Then he whirled with his hand on his gun and looked straight into the grinning face of his son. So completely had he made up his mind that the boy was dead that now he blinked in a ghostly fear. Then he straightened, caught Jack by the shoulders, and shoved him against the wall.
Hey! Let go, will you? Let go! I ain't made of leather. What's all the fuss about?
The sheriff stepped back, still choking with relief and happiness.
We gave you up. What happened, Jack? How come you to get off the trail? Did you fly? We got a gent down in the cells that I was getting ready to hang, and here you pop up with a dried skin.
A gent on a roan hoss?
That's the one.
I wish you'd hang him anyway. He was the cause of killing the Brown, and he near killed me too. Tried to ride between me and the wall. He done it too, and pushed the Brown over the cliff. I jumped just in time, but I hit my head against a rock. When I come to, he was gone. It was getting dark, so I turned and got back here without nobody seeing me. But you don't have to turn that skunk loose, do you?
Well, no matter what happened, it was your fault. You had no call to ride the one-way trail south.
Who'd have thought there was such a fool in the world as to ride that trail north against such a wind? Anyway, I was in a hurry.
The sheriff sat down, mopping his forehead clear of perspiration, though the room was cold.
It all seems like the insides of a dream. I'm just waiting to wake up. But what made you in such a hurry?
I told you I had to have 300. I did have to have it. It was a matter of life and death.
300? Where am I to get 300 every time you turn around? You spend more than I do the way it is. What made it a matter of life and death? Whose life and death?
Mine.
Yours? What have you been up to? What you been doing, Jack? I know you played the skunk more than once, but I never knew you had the nerve to do something that needed killing to pay you back.
Jack's head lowered, and he cringed toward the floor.
It's Kruger. He cleaned me out of the money with his slick card playing. He just makes the cards talk in a poker hand. I didn't have no chance with him. When I couldn't pay, he wouldn't hear of waiting. Said that he'd come gunning for me if I didn't show up with the cash. He gave me till yesterday to get it. I tried cards. I tried everything, even you, to raise the coin. But I couldn't, and I didn't want to kill a man just because I owed him money. So I decided to slip out.
You didn't want to kill a man. You didn't want to kill a man. Why? You ran to save your skin and you know it.
Nobody else could talk to me like that. I got a standard from you, but one of these days...
Well, one of these days what?
You'll be sorry for it. Now, the point is, what am I going to do?
You're going to go out there and face that rat Kruger without the money and tell him he has to wait for it. That's what you're going to do.
He's a gunfighter.
For a moment, father gazed on son with unutterable contempt. But then sadness succeeded scorn.
Yeller. And so yeller that I suppose it must have been born in you just that way. Well, Jack, if you won't fight him, you'll have to run again. But I've made up my mind to one thing. I'm going to make a change with Allison. I'm going to go right down now and bring her up here and ask her once and for all if she wants to marry you. If she says yes, all well and good. If she says no, then I won't hold her to it.
Good Lord! Ain't she rich? Can't she be the making of both of us? Are you going to throw away a whole fortune just because you're a little peeved at me right now?
Peeved at you? Well, Jack, you can call it what you want. But I'm going down now and get her. She's too good for you. I know that. But I'll settle this.
As he opened the door to the cellar, something stopped him. His whole body trembled with something akin to fear. So great was his wonder. It must be Allison. And yet, Allison laughing? It was impossible. To be sure, in the old days, when her father was alive, she had been a merry little child, but...
Well, it's years and years since I heard her laugh.
It was a horrible thought, this one, that a young girl had not laughed for so long a time that he could not remember.
What's got her laughing now?
He stepped cautiously down and peered below the floor level, through the little forest of upright bars, each faintly marked in place with a sketchy silver penciling of light from the lantern and from the lamp that Allison had put down. There she stood in profile before him, and what an Allison he saw! The fairy godmother had struck her with a wand. The fairy had stripped the drab away and clothed her in sudden beauty. She clasped her fingers about two bars of the shifter's cell, holding her face close to the bars, her eyes bright, the last radiance of the laughter slowly dying from her face. The shifter sat on the edge of his bunk with his hands clasped about his knees, teetering slowly back and forth. Certainly, he was an amazing young man to sit there so calmly, charged with murder.
But you haven't told me... You haven't told me why you're here.
I'm here because someone disappeared, and they say I'm the cause of it.
Her forehead creased. Then she started. It was wonderful to the sheriff to see the play of emotion in her. He had known her for so long as having simply a white mask of a face. Here stood a woman before him, young, capable of joy and sorrow, tears and laughter. The sense of her filled the gloomy cellar like a light.
Does that mean you're accused of...
Yes, but don't say it. It's a hard black word. It couldn't sound pretty even from your lips. Well, what are you thinking about? You shouldn't be down here with a man like me.
He rose to his feet, more serious than before.
Oh, no! Of course!
She stretched out her hand toward him with a graceful little gesture of trust.
I know that you're innocent. I know that. I'm only wondering how you can be saved. How you can get away.
By unlocking the door of the cell?
Yes. I think I might be able to get the keys. They're in the sheriff's office.
And he's the man you're so afraid of?
I'd risk it. If it would be any help to you.
No, I won't let you do that. Why, that old devil would make your life a plague. Besides, it wouldn't do me any good.
The sheriff crouched lower against the stairs and gripped his long, bony hands together. It was true. To this youngster, he was a veritable devil. He looked at the shifter with a pang. The makings of a man showed in that boy. He had heard enough before of the fighting exploits of the shifter. And from that last speech, he could guess at his generosity and true, quiet courage. Indeed, there were plentiful makings of a man in him, such a man as the sheriff had dreamed once of having in his son.
Besides, I'm not going to break away. They can't hang an innocent man. It can't happen. The truth always comes out at the last minute. I've seen it. Looks pretty black for me, I know. I've been tolerable hard. Done my share and more fighting. But I'm through with that. I'm going to get out of this mess. Then I'm going to settle down right here in this town where I've made such a bad start. I'm going to show them that I'm all right. I'm going to make them like me, just as I've made a pile of others fear me. But making people afraid of you is bad medicine. Look here. You ain't afraid of me, are you?
Afraid of you? Why, that's silly.
You're a steady one, right enough. You're the sort of stuff a square gent is made of. You'd stick to a friend through thick and thin.
If I ever found one, of course I would.
You have no friends?
No. They all think I'm strange, the people in Varden City.
People in Varden City are a pile of fools if they think that. And I'll show them they are. I'll tell you what. When I get out of this, do you know what I'm going to do?
Tell me.
How very eager she was, and how close she stood to the bars. The shifter in turn came close. Their hands were nearing.
I'm going to get you away from this old scarecrow of a sheriff and take you off where you'll have good folks around you. Someplace where you'll learn to laugh and dance and always have a good time. Understand?
I don't know. I suppose there are such places.
Why, right here in Varden City is such a place. But the point is, would you go with me?
Would it be right?
I'd make it right.
Oh, I don't know. I think I'd have to go if you asked me to.
Do you mean that?
Yes.
You'd be happy then?
Oh, don't you see? I've never been happy before, it seems, except just now, talking to you.
The sheriff saw fire gleam in the eyes of the shifter. But then the gunfighter drew back a little, drew inside of himself, and ground his knuckles across his forehead.
Oh, what's the matter?
I'm trying to think. Trying to think what's right for you. That's what comes first.
The sheriff waited to hear no more. He dragged himself up the stairs and into the hall again, softly closing the door with trembling fingers. He was so suddenly weak and sick at heart that he slumped against the wall. Yes, the shifter was such a youngster as he had hoped to have in Jack. No matter how wild he had been, he would turn out all right. If he took this girl away, he would make her happy as a queen. He would make himself over for her sake. She would have the molding of him. They would work together in the honest partnership which makes a home.
What will become of Jack?
Only through the girl could he save Jack. It was brutally clear to him. No, she must not be sacrificed. She must not go down. As the sheriff stepped into his office and closed the door, he looked over his boy with a glance which, for the first time in his life, penetrated to vital matters inside. He could begin to see the truth, not easily, but with a slow and grim grappling. All that he saw made him sick at heart. He himself had made a sad mess of matters, he told himself. But one thing at least could never be said of him. He had never done anything wrong in spirit. In his heart of hearts, he had always tried to do right by everyone.
You're afraid of Krueger?
Me? Afraid of him? Well, you see,
Don't talk to me, good Lord. A son of mine showing yeller like you're doing? Well, you showed it, and that's an end. But I'll tell you this, Jack, you're in worse trouble than you know. If you go down in the village and let folks know that you're alive and that another gent has been in danger of hanging because of you, you'll get some hard words.
But I'm not going down into the village! I'm not gonna let those folks know that I've come back from the pass!
You're gonna let folks go on thinking that the shifter killed you?
Why not? What does it matter? Only means that he'll be in jail a couple days. Anyway, the truth will come out before he comes to trial. But all I ask is that you don't tell him till I get clear of the country. You'll do that, Dad. You won't let him know. Krueger would come after me like a hungry dog. And he's a killer. A killer!
Do you know what it means to be in a cell under the accusation of murder?
I don't know. I don't care. I only know that I gotta get clear of this country before Krueger, curse him, knows that I'm here.
What do you intend to do?
I'll go up in the hills. I'll take a blanket and a can of beans and go up in the hills. I know where I can find shelter. I'll rest there a day or two, and then I'll strike out.
You'll leave Varden City for good?
Until you get rid of Krueger.
I'll never get rid of him. Jack, I've tried you out for a good many years. You listen to me while I talk plain earnest. I've tried you out, and you ain't no good. The shifter is a real man. Sized up alongside of him, you simply don't count. That's what opened my eyes. I'll tell you this. You gotta get out and stay out. Get out of Varden City. Get out of my life. I'm through with you. You'd let the shifter hang if you could. Well, that opens my eyes to you. Get out and stay out. That's final.
John Clark took out a well-filled wallet and tossed it behind him without looking as he left the room. In his parlor, the sheriff stood at the window and stared into the blackness until he could make out the tops of the trees around the house swinging to and fro in the full current of the wind. He turned back, shivering, and took down a heavily lined raincoat from the peg. It would be cold outside in that driving blast of rain. He himself was already cold to the heart. This, however, could be remedied. From a closet, he drew forth a brown jug of ample dimensions, and uncorking it, he poured into a water glass a great portion of colorless moonshine. He was normally a very temperate man, but now he drank it off with a toss of his hand, and frowned as he felt the alcohol scorch his throat and burn into his vitals. He was better for it, however. It numbed the thing torturing him. It freed his mind. It was even possible to consider the whole affair without heat. The main thing was to undo the wrong to Allison. For that, he must have time for thought. Above all, he wanted to be among friends. Jack must be gone by this time, and the sheriff thought of the boy shrinking when the storm cut against his face. That was the trouble. He had raised Jack too tenderly. If he had the thing to do over again, he would do it differently. Force was the thing. Force, force, force. What made the ball so
fine? Allison, what have I done with your life?
John Clark stepped into the kitchen. Allison looked up at him with a dish in one hand, a dish towel in the other, the ghost of a smile leaving her face.
Allison.
He was horror-stricken as he realized how much he had taken from this young life. How much a single short conversation with a condemned man had restored to her. Then he saw her waiting patiently, her head obediently bowed, waiting for him to continue his speech. It was the attitude of a slave, the crushed spirit of a slave, and he had done the crushing.
Allison, I've been wrong. Wrong from the start. Understand that, girl?
At this, she glanced up at him, glanced up with something akin to fear widening her eyes. Plainly, she did not understand, and because she did not understand, she was afraid. His thought flashed back to her father, his best friend. Heaven be praised that her father could not see her now.
What I mean is that I intend you should be happier, Allison. You need happiness. I've had a wrong idea. I'm going to try to make up to you all the things I've been wrong in. You understand, honey?
Her smile was cold and wan. Her nod was one he could see of perfunctory acquiescence.
Yes.